From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
The other thing we have to do is create new bidding procedures for the drug industry because they're getting away with murder.
President-elect Donald Trump put the pharmaceutical industry on notice. Boston biotech leaders react. Also today, our world is changing faster than ever before, but our institutions aren't evolving with the times.
We are educating kids as if they're going to end up on top of a mountain by themselves with no cell phone and just a number two pencil.
The director of MIT's Media Lab says he's got a new set of rules for how to think, live, and thrive in an age of constant disruption. And the Speakeasy Stage Company's production of Hand to God, the dark comedy that explores faith and morality with puppets.
You do not fear my power?
I think I can take down a puppet on the hand of an unathletic child.
It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President-elect Donald Trump is not doing business as usual, and yesterday he took aim at the American pharmaceutical and biotech industries.
They're getting away with murder. Pharma has a lot of lobbies, a lot of lobbyists, and a lot of power, and there's very little bidding on drugs. We're the largest buyer of drugs in the world, and yet we don't bid properly, and we're going to start bidding, and we're going to save billions of dollars over a period of time.
That was from the president-elect's press conference yesterday. He presented no specific plan, but he surely has the attention of Boston's enormous biotech sector. And joining me now with some reaction is longtime Boston biotech leader Deborah Dunsire. She's former CEO of Forum Pharmaceuticals and of Millennium Pharmaceuticals, and she was leading Millennium when Japanese drug maker Takeda bought the company in 2008 for almost $9 billion. Deborah Dunsire, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Meghna. It's great to be here.
So first of all, give us your reaction when the president-elect yesterday started talking about controlling drug prices.
I think the first thing we can say is that it isn't surprising. On the campaign trail, Mr. Trump had raised this issue. I do take issue with the characterization of a life-saving industry which has transformed human health being characterized as getting away with murder. But I think we can look forward to further scrutiny on pricing. And I think it is up to the industry to demonstrate the value for the innovation, the performance of the innovation, and the fact that the innovation should be paid for.
Do you think this scrutiny is justified?
I think it's inevitable given some of the bad acting that we saw from companies who are not the traditional industry and who have not been focused on innovation. And I think about Martin Shkreli and Turing Pharmaceuticals, which is not a pharmaceutical company in the sense of bringing forward innovation. And after those type of bad actions, it's, I think, inevitable that pricing will be in the spotlight.
Right. Do you think that there's the possibility amongst the companies, you know, legitimately in the biotech and pharma sector that all it might take is this kind of rhetoric from the president-elect to effect some change? Because I was looking back that in December at the Forbes Healthcare Summit, the chief of Allergan, Brent Saunders, said that he was going to, A, expand a patient assistance program to help people pay for the drug that his company makes to get sure that they could get access for some of those medicines, especially for mental illness, and that he also pledged not to make large price increases, limiting the drug price increase to 10% or no more than 10% once a year.
Right. I happened to hear him speak on Tuesday in San Francisco at the J.P. Morgan meeting. Biotech conference that starts off the year. And he reiterated the same thing. Allergan had taken a 9.9% price increase, of which they realize a net of about 2 to 3% given discounts and rebates. And he urges restraint, and I think the industry has demonstrated some restraint as we've gone through the end of 2016 and into 2017. And leaders among the industry are talking about demonstrating both restraint on pricing, but also a much clearer description of why products are priced as they are, more pay for performance in terms of the ability of products to deliver, and also the value of the innovation brought forward.
And so how do you do that? I mean, because, for example, I'm looking at comparative prices of certain drugs. Let's take, for example, Humira, which is an arthritis or anti-inflammatory drug. It seems in the U.S. it can cost up to $3,000. In Canada, it's priced at $1,900. In the U.K., priced at $1,100. I mean, when people see that, they're getting a certain message about the value that they're paying for in the United States versus other countries. So how would you change what that message is when the price is such a powerful indicator?
Yes, it is a powerful indicator. The unfortunate thing is that what we see in that price is not actually what gets paid. The opacity of the pricing system, the list price is discounted to various pharmaceutical benefit managers, to the government, by very significant amounts that increase over time. But the actual price that's paid is not disclosed, and it's considered a competitive issue between companies. So the challenge is that opacity, and we're talking as an industry about how to be clearer. The worldwide chairman of pharmaceuticals for Johnson & Johnson on Tuesday also spoke about a pledge they have made to disclose in aggregate things like the rebates. So trying to make this opaque pricing system a little bit more transparent so people understand that the list price is not the price that gets paid in most instances.
I see. So to sort of take the edge off sticker shock, in other words.
Yes.
Okay. And do you think that, and is there interest across the industry in doing something that because that sounds like quite a significant change, because one could make the argument that the opacity is there because it provides competitive advantage between companies.
I think that there is a competitive edge to, if you're rebating to a particular buyer, what you're rebating gives you access, and so there is a competitive edge. But I think as an industry, we need to find a way to be clearer with the American public and our patients what is happening, and the fact that the industry is not reaping the benefit of these list prices.
Now, overall, how do you and your colleagues in Boston's biotech sector, enormous and important, obviously for biotech as a whole, but also especially for this region, I mean, do you look upon the Trump presidency as one that, you know, it could be is going to be good for biotech, not good? I mean, what's the feeling amongst your colleagues?
I think at the moment the we're waiting to see how the policies evolve over time. Very important will be policies on tax, any repatriation of trapped capital from outside could make an investment in biotech in the U.S. more feasible. We look at regulation from an FDA standpoint. That's going to be very critical. We're looking with interest at who Mr. Trump is considering for FDA commissioner. There are many ways in which the industry can be helped or harmed by different policies. And right now, none of those are abundantly clear. So we're waiting with interest to see how we can go forward. But what's clear is that this industry can transform patients' lives through innovation and has done so for many years, will continue to do so. And we need a climate that fosters investment and the ability for patients to access care.
Forgive me for pressing you on this, but I'm just curious, is the industry concerned that government under President Trump could transform the industry?
Yes. I think any president, any administration has the ability to do that for better or for worse. And there are policies that can significantly foster innovation, speed development, bring new drugs to patients faster. And there are policies that could harm investment in innovative industry.
Well, Deborah Dunsire is former CEO of Forum Pharmaceuticals and of Millennium Pharmaceuticals. She was heading Millennium when Japanese drug maker Takeda bought the company back in 2008 for $8.8 billion. Deborah Dunsire, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's turn now to Dr. Don Berwick. He's a pediatrician, founding president, and current senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in Cambridge. He's also former chief of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He served there under President Barack Obama. Pharma. Dr. Berwick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be here, Magna. Thank you very much.
So first of all, let me ask you the same question I asked Deborah Dunsire. When you heard President-elect Donald Trump yesterday saying that it's time for we, I'm not sure who he was referring to as, in terms of bargaining more for drug prices, what was your reaction?
Well, he finally said something I agree with. I think that the pace of increase of pharmaceutical costs in this country is unsustainable. It's confiscatory. It's really hurting patients. It's hurting the system as a whole, and it's taking money away from other things we need it for, and it's unnecessary. We absolutely need to do something about it. It's going to take some real political courage.
Mm. Well, give us sort of the drug prices 101 right now in terms of what the government can or can't do, because as far as I've understood, Congress has tied Medicare's hands in part in terms of it can't really bargain for drug prices.
Yeah, we can start there. Medicare and Medicaid are the largest purchasers of drugs, I think, in the world. And even though I was running Medicare and Medicaid, I was forbidden by law from negotiating prices. It's simply a result of very heavy-handed lobbying on Capitol Hill, and it's worked for years and years. There's no authority in this government to look for a good deal in buying even the same drug. So that could be changed. It could be changed tomorrow.
If Congress would want that, and I'm not sure a GOP-led Congress would be amenable to that idea.
It requires statutory change. When President-elect Trump spoke at his press conference, he said we have to have bidding. That's what he's talking about. And so, don't underestimate the political viscosity here. I was told when I was running Medicare, for example, that there was one drug company that made one drug that had 200 lobbyists on Capitol Hill. This is an extremely forceful and capable lobbying group, maybe the most so in the whole country. So if Trump means it, it's going to be a fight.
Mm. So just to be clear, though, unlike in other countries, the government or in Medicare here doesn't have as many levers to pull in terms of negotiation.
That's correct. In Medicare especially. There are a couple of things going on with the VA, for example, the Veterans Administration and Medicaid, which involved discounts. But no, it's nothing like a real market that would be at work here in which the government can negotiate as a big purchaser for something it's buying a lot of.
Okay. But doesn't Medicare already have some options in terms of, if not negotiation, tools that it can use to help control drug prices? Because here's an example. I was reading about Dendreon. It's a Seattle biotech that I think has been since bought and sold by Valeant Pharmaceuticals. But anyway, they had a cancer drug that when it was introduced, it first cost $93,000 back in 2010, and Medicare put that drug through something called a national coverage determination, which slowed its adoption and perhaps had an effect on price?
Maybe some effect on price. It's quite weak. The ability of Medicare to do national coverage determinations, that is to say, you know, what does this drug actually accomplish, should we cover it, and so on, is extremely limited. Most things that Medicare cover never go through that kind of determination. They're done by local determinations or just according to common practices. So no, there really aren't many teeth in Medicare to do anything about that.
Okay. So, you know, I asked Deborah Dunsire a little earlier about other changes that could be put into effect within the industry itself. And, you know, she talked about, for example, working on price opacity to communicate more clearly to buyers and patients about, you know, aspects of why something costs what it does and what benefit it brings. Do you think that that could be of significance?
Yes, it could. I think overall, I want to just concur with Ms. Dunsire. It's very important to preserve innovation in the industry. The problem is there's no evidence whatsoever of relationship between costs and prices on the one hand and research vigor on the other. So that's a bit of a smokescreen. But yes, transparency would help. The drug companies are very secretive about the pricing, also secretive about their own costs. For example, they claim they're doing a ton of innovation and they need the money to do it. We know they're spending more money on advertising than on innovation, and they've been extremely reluctant to show any public information on the amount they're putting into research. So I'm a big fan of transparency. I think it would help. Of course, for a lot of the drugs that are of concern, there is no competition. These are specialty drugs, only one of a kind, at least for some period of time. And the companies, they're just pricing arbitrarily. Competition wouldn't help with those drugs because they can just name any number they want and they can get it. And for that, we're going to have much more forceful activity and possibly even some real controls put in from government. Mm. Again, that'd be a fight, but competition can't solve all of that.
Dr. Berwick, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, and understand, even for some simple drugs like insulin, for example, the price of insulin, which is made by very few companies in this country, but it's a basic, simple drug. That's gone up not every year, but every 3-4 months, so that people who are dependent on insulin need, they're over a barrel. They have to find the money, which means they're going to give up something else. And I'm not sure what competition can do about that. That's going to have to be regulation, or better, if the pharmaceutical industry would show some real self-restraint, which they have not done, maybe that would be a way to buy some time.
And maybe that is what might happen, because I've got to ask you finally in the last couple seconds we have, Dr. Berwick, I mean, you yourself, during your time in Washington, know about how recalcitrant Congress can be, right? Like, Congress wouldn't even hear or let you have your hearing to make you permanent head of Medicare, which is why you left Washington. Here we have a GOP-controlled Congress, which I don't think is showing any interest in changing Medicare's ability to negotiate on drug prices at all, regardless of what the president-elect says. So, I mean, could we possibly be in a situation where we are relying on the president-elect to say what he says, and that perhaps being enough motivation for changes to come from within the industry?
Yes, I don't want to let Congress off the hook. We could fix it. This is not that hard. We know what laws and regulations and scrutiny would help. We could do it. But if the pharmaceutical industry sits there and allows Mylan to increase the price of EpiPens to an absolutely absurd level, and the industry says nothing about it, they do not earn public trust. So maybe this president, the president-elect, will call them to task and say, no, you can't behave that way, and some kind of voluntary self-restraint will start to appear. I surely hope so.
Well, Dr. Don Berwick is a pediatrician, founding president, and current senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in Cambridge, and also former chief of Medicare and Medicaid. Don Berwick, thanks so much.
Thank you, Magna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You know technology is transforming our world quickly, but it's happening even faster than you think. For example, when a business brings a new server online, how long do you think it takes before that server gets compromised? For example, before it gets infected by, say, a virus? You think it takes a year? A month? A week? Well, Jeff Howe, professor at Northeastern University, has the answer.
When a new corporate server comes online, it will be compromised in 25 minutes.
25 minutes. Yeah, I had the same reaction too.
Like, that just that the network, the internet, is such an enmeshed collection of such a dense weave in ways that we, the human brain, can't even conceive.
In other words, our Homo sapien brains aren't all that different from how they were wired back when we sheltered in caves. But those same brains have created a world that's changing faster than we can understand or cope with. That's why Howe, along with Joy Ito, director of MIT's Media Lab, got together and created what they're calling a new operating system for the world. It's in their new book called Whiplash. They're pro tips, really, for retraining our brains and societies. Things like prioritizing disobedience over compliance, seeing the world as groups of systems rather than objects, and navigating life thinking you've got a compass to get you through uncertainty rather than a map that falsely projects certainty. Well, I spoke with Jeff Howe and Joy Ito about their book and started by asking them what makes the time we're living in now categorically different than other moments in history where technology produced transformational change.
First of all, I think there are more things coming together at the same time. So you've got AI and synthetic biology and the internet and Moore's Law. So first of all, it's hitting all together and they all sort of accelerate and affect each other. So there's a bunch of things that make this a very peculiar time.
I think it's what Joey said. It's not even so much. I mean, I do think that the pace of change is increasing, but it is this confluence that we're not at it yet, but it is soon. And it's gene editing techniques, it's artificial intelligence, and it's just fascinating that technology can move at this really rapid pace. But it takes a long time for humans, especially institutions, I think, to change and to innovate and to see what innovations will stick and what do people want. There's a lot of trial and error that have to take place.
Can you give us a couple examples of technologies right now, you think, that are outpacing our ability as a society to understand them?
So there's CRISPR, which is the ability to edit genes very cheaply. But Kevin Esvelt in my lab is working on CRISPR Gene Drive, which is the ability to use CRISPR to modify an organism like the genes of, say, a mosquito so that it's resistant to Zika. But what CRISPR Gene Drive does is creates a system so that all of the offspring between this modified mosquito and any other mosquito in the wild, all of the offspring inherit this resistance. So you could feasibly deploy a modified mosquito that's resistant to Zika and then within several generations eliminate any mosquito that could carry Zika. And so the question is, who decides? How do you engage the affected communities? And then also, how do you prevent people from doing irresponsible things? Because with CRISPR, it's now high school kids can do it. And it's just the beginning. The things like CRISPR will continue to come out.
Just to give you an idea of the speed, CRISPR was discovered after we started working on the book, was perfected around the time we began composing the book, like really getting into the writing, and had reached high schoolers by the time we were in edits.
And one key thing as a scientist, which is important, is the first deployment of a technology often affects the way the public thinks about it. So if electricity, you know, had not been lighting up Paris, but had been electric chairs, people would have a very different view of electricity at the beginning. Whereas GMOs, you know, the first deployment was really kind of a company trying to sort of prevent people from having freedom. So there's a sort of very negative view of GMOs when, in fact, GMOs can be used to do wonderful things. And so one of the things we want to be very careful about with CRISPR Gene Drive is that the initial deployments are managed by the people who are affected and are done in a really responsible way, because if they are done in an irresponsible way, I think it will really set back our ability to do research.
This is so fascinating because, as you write in the book, the sort of cycle of technology in the past was this ferocious period of development, then some stasis, right? So we as a society were sort of able to catch up. But what you're saying now is that the disruption is constant. The pace of change is so fast that that luxurious time that we had as individuals and society to sort of figure things out, we may not have that anymore.
And I think, I mean, if you think about architects or, say, policymakers as sort of central planners, it used to move slowly enough that you could kind of manage things. The problem is when you get complex and you get fast, it becomes kind of like the Soviet Union. You can't centrally plan something that complex. And so what you need to do, and we call this participant design, which is that instead of top-down design, you have to let every element in the system sort of be responsible for its own design and be kind of bottom-up. So you're not stuck in traffic, you are traffic. So it's not like the central scientist or a company delivering stuff to the public. It should be everybody.
Yeah, so let me ask you, because, I mean, you talk about the internet in quite a bit of detail, and I just want to read a little section here. You say, the internet has played a key role in this, providing a way for the masses to not only make their voices heard, but to engage in the kind of discussion, deliberation, and coordination that just recently were the province of professional politics. Now, I think we're living in a moment right now where we're also wrestling with the potential downside this aspect of emergent systems. I mean, I'm in the news business, so I'm thinking, like, everyone's talking about the danger of fake news, right? And that's also part of different constituents having a voice in the discussion. So how do we manage what are the potential negative aspects of these systems as they come up?
You know, I think there was an unfortunate, like, sort of a techno-utopianism, that there was an embrace of technology as sort of inherently democratizing, and that was an unconditional good. Like, democracy will always be good. If you get more people involved, that's more equitable, it's more fair. And it's like, well, guess what? Sometimes getting more people involved means that, you know, you don't like the product of their decisions, or that it makes it easier to promulgate lie and rumor and calumny. And I think we're seeing the effects of that. And we have to remember that technologies are neutral.
Yeah, and I think if you were to compare the two candidates, I think Donald Trump had a, I mean, this may sound controversial, but I think he reflects the principles in the book much better than Hillary did. He rode the wave of a lot of the stuff that's happening. So, and you know, to be honest, if you look at the Twitter data from our lab, it shows that the mainstream media journalists were not connected to the Trump supporters' conversations on Twitter at all, right? So they weren't talking to each other. And so I think this should be a wake-up call to people who are trying to run top-down political systems, journalists who are just talking to each other. And there's a kind of elitism that's happened. So I, you know, again, I'm thinking about science. If you think about the original moonshot, we had kids in Iowa building model rockets, right? This was an optimistic dream that included everyone in America. Now the moonshots are kind of Silicon Valley moonshots or yeah. or sort of the medical establishment in Washington, D.C. and Boston. And we kind of left a whole bunch of people behind. And so I feel like, again, assuming that democracy is a corrective system and that we do take this moment to sort of be reflective, I think it's a great reflection of exactly the whiplash that we've created where the sort of elite have, you know, gone ahead of the body. And the body is sort of left behind.
So really, as you write in the book, you're trying to offer us all, you know, a new OS for the world, right? But underlying this, I mean, you confront a fundamental truth about, in your words in the book, our current cognitive toolset leaves us ill-equipped to comprehend the profound implications. Mm-hmm. And that your mission is to provide readers with tools to bring our brains into the modern era. So what is in our current cognitive tool set that makes us ill-equipped to deal with our present and future?
I mean, an addiction to this illusion of certainty. The world has never been a very predictable place, but now there is real cost associated with pretending that it is. You know, and you should have a better shot of it. You had your sales team, you brought them all together, and you spent weeks putting together your sales forecast, and it might have, you know, a decent shot of giving you an idea of what future earnings would be. But, you know, volatility is increasing across the board, whether it's just commercial or planning for your family or an institution planning for its future.
It is impossible to know everything and to be sure. So it's kind of this idea of feeling okay with the fact that the place is out of control, that you sort of go with the flow, that being prepared is much better than having a plan. There was a great John Cleese joke, how do you make God laugh? Tell him your plans. Yeah. You know, and so it's kind of an anti-planning approach, but it doesn't mean that you just then don't do anything. You have to spend that energy that you used to spend planning and learning and knowing everything in completeness to developing an ability to sort of know what's going on, to be agile. I think a lot of what institutions do these days is they start out on a mission, and then they get so modular and so organized and so scalable that by the time you look at them, whether you're talking about the Humane Society or Twitter, you sort of forget why you're doing what you're doing.
So personally, as I try myself to cope with and navigate all the changes that we're all living through, I veer wildly between like techno-utopianism and techno-dystopianism, honestly. Mm-hmm. But what I appreciated about this book is it does give you a tool set about how to not fall in either extreme and chart a more sensible path forward. But I wanted to ask you, it makes me think that in terms of young people today, we're not teaching them any of the right skills.
Yeah, we are educating kids as if they're going to end up on top of a mountain by themselves with no cell phone and just a number two pencil, right? In fact, you have a phone with Google and messaging. And so what kids intuitively know is they don't have to memorize everything, that they're going to have friends who are experts about something and they'll talk to them if they're experts at something else. And so the notion of being always connected to people, resources, and not having to learn knowledge and skills that you get online so you can spend the same amount of time in the space and that brain power on something else. Mm-hmm. And so that's very different because now you're learning to learn and you're learning to search rather than sort of memorizing and stalking as if you're going to be out on the, you know, in the wilderness by yourself all the time.
You know, to put like a fine point on it, like Horace Mann comes in the 19th century and reforms American education to make it compulsory. So everyone's going, but to to make people who could then go out and act like a widget. And this was a philanthropic urge. Like, he wanted people to be able to survive and be employed, but they were going to have to become part of an assembly line to do that. So you get things like periods and punctuality and looking at the clock. Most people coming from agrarian environments, they didn't look at watches or clocks. So you have to inculcate this in. The problem now is if Horace Mann were alive, he'd be like, hey, dummies, drop it. Like, it's the opposite. If people are going to act like machines, our machines got really good. Like, it's the one way they'll never be employed is if they, so they have to become good at stuff that machines can't do. Meanwhile, our educational system, just as Joey said, is teaching them to do things that machines can do. It's crazy. Yeah.
I do think that we're eliminating passion, which is a key driver. We have a group at the Media Lab called Lifelong Kindergarten, because we believe kindergarten is one of the best learning experiences, and we should continue that, which is, we say, the four P's: project, peers, passion, play. So instead of textbooks, which things you learn in textbooks are very hard to apply out of context, learn through projects. Peers, learning from each other. Kids are known to remember things that they hear from friends more than they remember it from teachers. And in fact, when you teach, you remember the best. Passion, pick the project that you want to work on. So if it's World War II history, that's what you do. And then you learn math and you learn geography. And this is, you know, in the world of AI, you want people to have different opinions and different passions. And so you got to allow the kid to have passion. I meet a lot of kids coming into MIT, and they have all the skills. And you ask them, well, what do you want to do? And so
they
I don't know. So helping kids figure out what they want to be passionate about. And it can change over time, but always nurturing passion. The last B, play. It turns out creativity and thinking about things that aren't predictable, it turns out that play is the way that you get people to be creatives. And so as we think about a AI roboticized world, what you want kids to be is passionate, playful, collaborative, and project-oriented. And right now our schools are textbook-oriented. You better not be cheating, and we don't care whether you're passionate, and you sure shouldn't be playing too much.
Well, Joy Ito is director of the MIT Media Lab, and Jeff Howe is assistant professor at Northeastern University and coordinator of Northeastern's Media Innovation Project. They are co-authors of the new book, Whiplash. Thank you so very much, both of you, for coming in and for sharing this toolkit for the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Everyone's got that niggling voice in the back of their head, the one that says, maybe you don't always have to be so good. Maybe it wouldn't hurt to do the wrong thing once in a while, or say the thing you know you shouldn't. Well, a new dark comedy at the Speakeasy Stage Company explores what happens when that voice takes control as a demon hand puppet. The play is called Hand to God, and in this scene, Jason, the main character, has just thrown his puppet Tyrone out the window. But he wakes up in the middle of the night, and the puppet is back on his hand.
Tyrone, how'd you get better? How'd I get fixed? I didn't whine and ask questions. I just got that done. I'm glad you're feeling better. You don't want me better. You want me dead.
Well, perhaps even more interesting, Tyrone the puppet, that becomes a mouthpiece for the devil, was initially created for a Christian puppet ministry. Well, playwright Robert Askins wrote Hand to God, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. Now, tell me what the inspiration was. I mean, did you participate in a Christian puppet ministry as a kid?
My mother had a Christian puppet ministry when I was growing up. It wasn't like that Christian puppet ministry, but it wasn't too far off. I'm joking. It was great. It was formative, and it was strange. I've always surprised when I talk about it that it seems like a lot of people north of the Mason-Dixon line didn't even know that it existed. We had so many people who were like, that's so creative. That's so amazing.
But seriously, we should describe to people who don't know. Like, when Christian puppet
totally.
Ministry, is it Bible lessons, Bible study done through puppets?
It's usually these really amazing scripts written about tertiary characters.
Mm-hmm.
So the classic example is like the two camels with the wise men on the way to the birth of the baby Jesus. And so you get these really broad children's jokes, and then the message of salvation is slid in there. sometimes pretty awkwardly, but it's great.
And is the ministry, is it for kids mostly?
It is usually by kids for kids.
I see.
It is like the teenagers or the junior high students who are theatrically inclined for the younger kids, for
and
the 5 and 6
enjoy
year olds.
Doing it, the puppet ministry as
I was a theatrically inclined individual. And so it was, you know, one of the things I think it's difficult to express to some people is how, this is going to sound gross, ugly parts of the country are. And when I was growing up, there was a lot of natural beauty. But the only place that was architecturally or performatively interesting was the church. Like the only place where human language tried to rise to something, or where the windows were colored glass in order to make it feel special, was in the church. Do you know what I mean? Everything else was like blocky Bauhaus and then like corporate chic. But then like there was this place where words were magic and it was very exciting.
So I mean, by definition, it's the house where human spirit's supposed to rise to the divine, right?
Absolutely.
Well, we have a little bit of tape here from an actual Christian puppet ministry before we talk a little bit more about the fictional one that appears in your play, because I just wanted to give people a sense. And I mean, it's very common, like you said, it's a frequently used and popular form of ministry in many churches in the country. So this is a little clip from Heavenly Treasures puppet ministry. They happen to be based in upstate New York, and a little skit called Backpack to School.
Do you have room in that backpack for the armor of God?
The what?
The armor of God? You gotta take the armor of God to school with you.
The sword of the spirit might puncture her Barbie pencil box.
Very funny. Besides, my school has a zero tolerance policy on weapons. The sword is not a good idea.
Robert Askins, people cannot see how you reacted to that, but you were freaking out.
Oh my God, it was like coming home. It was like diving into a Cinnabon. That feels so right.
Yeah.
So right.
So tell me, where did you get the inspiration, though, to turn this real experience that you had as a child and twist it a little and make, you know, the story in Hand to God is that Tyrone the puppet becomes a vehicle for the devil.
I don't think there is anyone who grew up in the church or who is heavily churched that hasn't wanted to stand up in the service at some point and say, you're lying. That's wrong. I mean, I don't care how devout your faith is. Everyone doubts their faith. Times of stress, times of trial. And there is something, you don't do it. You look around in the middle of the prayer and you're like, who else is looking around here? And you try to catch somebody's eyes. And that feeling is part of where Tyrone is. But one of the saddest things about monotheism is you only have two settings. You only have divine revelation and then the demonic. Like, say what you want about polytheism, it gives you a couple more outs. So if you want to say those things, if you want to be honest about yourself, your only choice is the devil. And I think that's part of where the play comes from. I mean, I spent a long time writing sort of surreal westerns, you know, growing up in Texas. You know, Sam Shepard is a great model. But they just kept getting funnier and funnier and weirder and weirder and more specific to the way that I grew up. So it wasn't any more crime tales about small town crooks. It became about my mother's puppet ministry.
Are you in the church now?
I'm not. I think like a lot of people, I describe myself as spiritual but not religious. And I mean, I would love to find a church that says what I'd like to hear, or what I believe, or what I'm desperately longing for. But it's so hard to find.
So I've got to ask you. So this struggle, this questioning that you say is at the heart of Hand to God, told at times very sharply and darkly and at times very humorously through Tyrone the puppet. I mean, wouldn't many people of faith hear you say, but, Jesus himself questioned. So what's wrong with being one of those people who at some point in time in their journey of faith said you wanted to point out and say this is wrong, that to give voice to the devil?
Oh, there's nothing wrong. Like, I'm not trying to in any way condemn that or say that that is a negative impulse. I'm just saying it's a human impulse. And a lot of the time we have had a lot of devout believers who are not alienated by the show. We have some who are offended. But, you know, that's one of the interesting things about the wiggle room that comedy provides, is it allows for people to let themselves off the hook from dogma. The show is not dogmatic. The show is yearning and questioning and, I think, ultimately generous.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a little bit more from a performance of Hand to God. We have a clip from a scene where there are some kids in the puppet class and they meet Tyrone, the possessed puppet, I guess we can call him. And in this clip, you'll hear Tyrone starting and he's yelling at one of the kids, and the kid's name is Timothy.
Don't look at the kid! Look at me! Jason, I'm not going to talk to your puppet! Oh, look at the kid! And tell me who you think is in control here.
That's a really important question in the play. Who is in control?
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm like, the bleeps are just making it.
We are a family from the radio.
No, absolutely, 100%. I'm not advocating the lifting of a bleep. Who is control? Isn't that a great question about our lives? You know what I mean? Is it what I had for breakfast? Is it the last thing I listened to on the radio? You know, behavioral economics, like, how do I make a decision?
Yeah.
You know, it's incredibly complex. And I think, like, so many of these symbols that we invest with power control us as we try to control them. It's just hard to be human.
Yeah. No kidding. Well, I want to play one more clip here because you strike this tender balance between the darkness and the comedy here. And I want to play a little bit of the comedy part. And I have to say, it might even feel uncomfortable laughing, but uncomfortable laughing is important, I have to say. So here's a clip where the pastor of the church, Jason's mom, Jason being the young boy who has the puppet, and his crush, Jessica, they're discussing how to get rid of the puppet because the puppet has said he's the devil.
Mm-hmm. Is it the puppet that's possessed or Jason?
Huh. Jessica?
Oh, that is an interesting question.
I have had enough interesting questions for one day. The devil is in that puppet, and we are going to exorcise him right out and have everyone back home by midnight. That's what I want, and that's what Jesus wants, and that's what's going to happen, right? Mm.
Do Lutherans even do exorcisms?
I don't know. I don't think they do. Do they?
Oh, yeah.
They do.
Yeah. Okay. It's the line that follows, I believe, is after the Reformation, when the church split, it was really a popular service, but it's just not done much anymore. Which is true. It's still in the Lutheran canon.
I see. Have you performed the play or had the play staged in communities, where the audience was mainly Christian?
Absolutely.
And how did that go?
It went really well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we didn't have any walkouts. I don't think we've had any walkouts. Maybe we had some in London? I don't know.
In London?
Yeah, I think so. My joke was, you know, we need to make it so that we can sell the seat twice. So, like, walkout seats, we can sell at a discount. But we didn't have nearly as many as I thought we would. But no, I feel like, again, comedy, it's outrageous, and it's also human. So, you know, there's some for everybody.
Has your mom seen it?
Every iteration.
And?
She loves it. I mean, you know, again, it's so big that there are things that there are things that she knows she did, and then things that there's no way she would have done, and she gets to split the middle, and she also gets to laugh, and it's, you know, she had fun going to the Tonys. She'd never been to London before. Like, what are we gonna do?
Well, my last question to you wanted to loop back to sort of where we began in terms of your own childhood, because I believe there was one interview where you said that the southernness that you experienced, you grew up in Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the southernness you experienced was at once dangerous and balderized?
Whoa, golly.
What did you mean by that?
Balderization, right? So the guy that scrubs all the dirty parts out of Shakespeare. I think that's another one of those things about a kid wanting to stand up and say you're lying. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I see this world. I see this angry, aggressive world where the bully's tactics win. Don't you dare tell me that love is all I need. Give me love in equal measure with aggression so that I can defend what's right.
Well, Robert Askins is the playwright of Hand to God. It's on stage now at Speakeasy Stage Company. It'll run through February 4th. We've got a lot more information about it at our website, radioboston.org. Robert, thank you so much for the play, and thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Well, all of a sudden, we've got a race. Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson launched his campaign for Boston mayor just this afternoon at an event in Roxbury. He's challenging Mayor Marty Walsh, who began his first term in 2013. And Councilor Tito Jackson joins us on the line now. Councilor, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, Magna.
Okay, so why are you throwing your hat into the ring now?
I'm throwing my hat into the ring because we've lost our way to date, Magna. We've been paying attention to things like IndyCar as well as things such as the Boston Olympics, and we've not been paying attention to fully funding our education system. We've not been paying attention to the issues of working families and the displacement that we're seeing in the city of Boston. And that's not only in the Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan. You're seeing it in East Boston, South Boston, as well as Brighton and Alston. So we need to deal with the serious issues of working families in the city of Boston, and we have not been paying attention to those families.
Well, Councilor Jackson, though, back in 2013, you gave a very strong endorsement to Marty Walsh in his race against City Councilor John Connolly. It's only been a couple years since then. Don't you think the mayor deserves a chance to continue to enact, you know, the promises that he originally ran on?
Yeah, I believe that the people of the city of Boston deserve to have leadership that's going to focus on working families. Yes, that occurred in 2013, but the time is now to focus. And families can't wait. I deal with families all the time in my office. Actually, not only from my district, who are calling me, who are being evicted or pushed out of their homes. Families can't wait, and one of the biggest calls that I get in my office, and we talk about as a council, are jobs and economic opportunity in the city of Boston. So Boston can't wait another term for that. We actually need to seize the day and ensure that opportunities are provided for people in the city right now, today, and you have leadership that's actually going to be squarely focused on the people who are currently in the city of Boston, not only those who are seeking to bring here.
Interesting. So, are you saying that Mayor Marty Walsh hasn't focused enough on the good of the on good for the people who live in the city of Boston? Is that what you're saying?
I noted, I believe that we have been really distracted. When 4,000 young people have to walk out of school for us to fully fund their education, and we still cut it by $22 million, that autistic students are in larger classrooms, and we have librarians that were cut, and we are not fully funding our public schools, that is a problem. And that's not the type of Boston that we should see. When we have families who can barely afford to live here based on rents, people are working full-time who are being pushed out and making decisions such as do we buy food or do we pay our rent, and also how do we afford our heat?
Yeah,
real issues that the city of Boston is facing today.
Councilor Jackson, I definitely take your point about the effects of income inequality in a place like Boston. But when you said about not fully funding our schools, part of that has to do with the state, but also in terms of, you know, money. The city has been putting extra money into the budget for Boston Public Schools. I think it's been doing a pretty decent job at that.
But Magna, there's something called inflation. Right. And so when it comes to we know that last year for the Boston Public Schools to do what they did the year before, they actually needed to add $40 million. The administration put only $18 million. And at the same time, there are many other parts of the budget that they found money for. In addition, they found money for $15 million bridge in South Boston. That's where GE was going to go. They found money for a helipad, a publicly funded helipad. So we are not focusing on working families, and we need to get back to our focus on working families and a city of Boston that is actually great for all. Remember, 50% of people in Boston make $35,000 or less. Those are folks that we also want to make and bring into the greatness of the city of Boston.
Right. Now, Councilor Jackson, as a Boston City Councilor, you know very well that a lot of what the city can do is limited by law, that most initiatives have to have the state legislature approve it. And let's be honest, Mayor Walsh is a former state representative. He's got a good working relationship with the governor and people on Beacon Hill. How would you be better equipped to get legislative approval for major city initiatives?
I think several things. We would would be thinking about budgeting 1, 3, 5, and 10 years as businesses do. But the other piece, I believe that there's an opportunity at the city level that there needs to be the will to actually use the dollars that we had. As I noted before, we had $115 million in net new revenue, and so those dollars could have been better allocated for the people in the city of Boston. I would work with the state legislature to close the over $1 billion underfunding of public schools in the state of Massachusetts. That is real, and we would work to get more charter reimbursement. And I want to thank you for moderating the No on Question 2 panel. Those are all things that we would continue to work on. So we need those relationships, but we need to do what we can do at the city level now, and that is focused on working families and communities who've been left behind.
Well, Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson has launched his run for Boston mayor. He did so this afternoon at an event in Roxbury, and he joined us on the line today. Councilor Jackson, thank you so very much.
And thank you for what you do, Magna.
It's going to be a great and interesting election year in Boston. We'll be on the mayor's race from now through November. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's it for today. This is Radio Boston. Thank you.